Okay, so now we have... Wow, I'm very proud of you all. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5... Only 6 questions. Wow, you really got the message. How many people wrote a question, looked at it, thought it was stupid, and threw it away again? Like I said last night. Really good. Okay, it's a sign that your meditation's gone very well today, because you're very still, so questions haven't come up. Either that, or you've been sleeping all day. Okay, this is a very deep question to start off with. I'm not sure if I can really handle this. This usually, maybe later on in the retreat. Are shorts suitable for outside meditation? That's a very deep one, that is. Are shorts suitable? It's a bit cold for shorts weather. I don't know, but if anyone wants to do that. Because it's another type of meditation which we do in monasteries. It's called the meditation on the loathsomeness of the body. So if you've really got ugly knees and legs, then it's a wonderful thing that you're doing for the sake of all other people. So they can have a look at your really ugly legs and think, oh, yuck. And that would give you a sense of dispassion towards bodies in the world. And that would mean that you become more able to sort of throw away the body and throw away concern for such things, to be able to let go and be free of all this body business. You look at their legs and you look at your legs and it's just about the same thing. Oh my goodness, I really am getting old. And then that will give you the sense of urgency, that to actually to really get your act together quickly, because your legs get older and older and older. Sometimes that people actually, they put a lot of cosmetics onto their face and onto their hair. They don't usually put much on their legs. So that must be a good indicator of just how old you're getting and how this body is falling apart. So, yes, it's a good idea. If you can stand the cold. Well, I hope not all the questions are that hard. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahm, this is the deeper one. Would someone with a big ego have a harder time meditating compared to someone who is less egotistical? Is there a correlation? Thank you. Yeah, I was mentioning that point yesterday, that people who have big egos have a terrible time meditating. When I was in the United States last November, I was told that I think Sharon Salzberg, she's written a couple of books on meditation, and one of her sort of disciples, what's her name? I think Amy Schwartz, I think her name is. She's I think the editor of Tricycle magazine now, but she's also on the staff of Oprah Winfrey. And apparently she talked Oprah into running a retreat in her mansion, meditation retreat, just for the weekend. These people, they do have big mansions. If you live in a mansion like hers, you don't need to build a retreat center, because her house has got enough rooms to put all of you and a few extra. So they had this meditation retreat in her mansion for the weekend, and she only lasted, I think, about 25 minutes before she had to run out. She couldn't stand it any longer. And actually, when you think about it, it's quite predictable that someone who is that strong in ego would have a terrible time letting go, because it goes completely against just what she has to do to get into such a limelight, to go for it, to have the big ego, to say, look at me. And when you're actually meditating, you've just got to disappear. That's why, you're sitting here, and you just, in this retreat, you're just a nobody. You're just somebody who sits in the third row and the fourth line, somewhere around the back somewhere. You're not prominent anymore. You don't even talk. You don't get any special privileges. You just completely disappear. You fade away in a retreat like this. You can't sort of just show that your existence. In fact, the longer you go on this retreat, the more you tend to disappear. So it's true that people with big egos, they're the ones, who always, we can actually see them when they're meditating, because they're really strong like this. They're really trying to prove something and show something. Because, they've done it in the world, they've done it with their relationships, they've got their degrees, now I'm going to do my meditation as well. Just another sort of notch on the belt of their achievements. And somebody who's that egotistical is missing the whole point of how to meditate. Because as Ajahn Chah famously said, in a very, very deep teaching, he said, you don't meditate to gain things, you meditate to give things away, to drop things. to let things go. It's a very lovely way of looking at things, because when we're meditating, we're just seeing how much can disappear, how much we can abandon. And if you look upon this as seeing what I can get from this meditation retreat, to see how many jhanas I can get, see how many enlightenment experiences I can get. If I can't get jhanas, enlightenment experiences, at least please, 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 may I get the ability to see the next lottery numbers coming up next week. Something out of this. But the point is that if you're doing it to try and get something, that is like the egotistical. Look at me, I can do this, I can make it happen, I'm going to crack it. It's the I thing which gets into the way. You can understand if the path of letting go, of renunciation, putting things away, the more egotistical you have, the more you tend to control. And this is just the problem of our world. Big egos tend to control a lot. Huge egos want to control the whole world. They become prime ministers and presidents. And yeah, you can see the problem there. And that control freak business is actually what we try and abandon. For those of you who know some traditional Buddhism, there's a character in the Buddhist pantheon. He appears very regularly in the Buddhist suttas. It's a guy called Mara, M-A-R-A. And this guy Mara is the bad guy of Buddhism. He's always, you know, stopping people meditating. He's always trying to stop people getting enlightened. Last Sunday I was giving a sutta reading, and in this particular sutta reading, it was about the Brahma Nimantanika Sutta. That's where the Buddha went up to actually to teach God, to put God in his place, to actually to say, "Lord God, you know, you are not the creator, the firstborn of the universe. You know, you came in here like everybody else, according to your karma from other realms. So don't get above yourself." And then Mara comes in and says, "Monk, don't sort of talk like that to God. This is God. You can't talk like that to God." And basically the Buddha said, "Why not? Because I know more than God does. I can do more." And then Mara says, "You know, if you behave yourself and worship God, then after you die, you can get reborn into a high plane. But if you don't, you get reborn into a low plane." And the Buddha said, "Look, I'm not going to get reborn again anyway, so what's the point?" But more than that, so the Buddha actually showed how enlightened he was. And then Mara just came along to him and says, "You know that before there were many enlightened beings, and when they taught, they got reborn in a lower realm. But when they didn't teach, they get reborn in a high realm. Monk, you don't teach." So Mara would do anything to try and stop the Buddha teaching the Dhamma. And this Mara is always the one who tries to stop people escaping from his control. And that being, the Mara, he lives in the realm of control freaks. The realm called the Paranimitta Wasawati realm, which literally means the realm of the beings who control others' creations. And this is what happens. A being, a Mara, because of their good karma, they get reborn into these states of existence. There's anyone who becomes a prime minister or a president, they have to have some good karma to get there in the first place. But when they get in there, the position corrupts them, and they get more and more into controlling. And the last thing they want is for beings to meditate and get beyond the control of the controller. And this is actually what what we do in meditation. We go beyond controlling, beyond the realm of Mara. And that's why it also says, the Buddha says, that when you go into the deep meditations, you go beyond Mara's control. You go where Mara cannot go. You go to where Mara is blindfolded, where the controller doesn't live. So it's when we let go of the controller, then we go deeper and deeper into meditation. So those with big egos have big controlling. That's how we measure the size of an ego, by just how much control they exert. So after a while you just let things go, especially in this meditation. Your effort, your control is to get to your bottom on that meditation seat, and afterwards then you let go and see what happens. So it's a very good question. Those who have big egos have a difficult time meditating. And those who actually see non-self, there's no one in there, you have an easy time meditating. One of the other sayings of the Buddha, whenever there is a self, an ego, there is always something belonging to a self. And that's actually how you know there's a self there, if there's something belonging to you. What we call attachments. So that when you let go of your attachments, at the same time you let go of your ego, yourself, what you own. And so the more you let go of the self, the less you tend to own. I don't mean just the physical possessions. You don't own your reputation, you don't worry about who says what to you, you don't care what other people think of you, because you don't own these things. You don't own the words, you don't even own the feelings in the body, you own nothing. So then you become someone who's got no burdens in life. Always they say that when you have possessions, it's not that you possess your material goods, your material goods possess you. So as we let go more and more, we feel more freedom. Unless you have the lighter your footprint is, you tend to skip and float instead of always trudging, dragging yourself through samsara like an ant through treacle. Sometimes that's what it feels like, doesn't it? Sometimes an ant with a backpack on as well, trudging through this really sticky stuff uphill. But when you don't own anything, when you have no ego, you have no possessions, then things just flow easily. And it's easy to let go then. It's easy to get into deep meditation. So that's what yesterday evening I was saying. The one good way to develop the meditation deeper is do a bit of like no self meditation. Just think of no self. Many of you have read the theory before, heard the theory, you've read the books, you understand it basically. There's nobody in here. At least you can take it on trust. Imagine there's no one in here. Imagine you own nothing. Imagine you're dying. You've got to let everything go anyway. So just let it go now. And that way you find it so easy to meditate. Does that make sense? Anyone want to come back on that one? Yeah? It's both. It's both the metaphor for the control inside of you, but it's also a being as well. Sometimes when a person gets very wealthy, they have all the sensory pleasures, they have all the material wealth. What's the next thing they really get into? They get into power trips. That's what a wealthy person does once they made their fortune. They want to get involved in usually politics to exert power. Because the pleasure of power is a bigger high than the pleasure of just material possessions or sensory delight. And so exerting power is one of the levels of happiness in the pantheon of beings. And it becomes the drug of power. And it corrupts, as Lord Acton famously said. So the less power you have, the more free you are. Does that make sense? But it's both. It's both. Mara is both a being, and also you can see it just inside yourself, the control of that samara. Come on, sit meditation properly. Come on, just do more. Come on, get your act together. That's all Mara speaking. So just say, shut up. Okay? Yeah. A little bit of self causes all the problems. No, don't. I do. I put your effort in. In other words, I condition. You've got no choice. So it's the effort is. It's a very wonderful thing, very rewarding to investigate what this effort is. What are you trying to do anyway? Where are you trying to get to? What are you trying to do it for? What's the effort motivating? Really, the effort should be just to abandon, to let go. And it's the effort which I said in that simile yesterday, when you're trying to hold a cup or a bottle of water still, that effort, even the lightest of effort, the thing will always move. It has to be a putting down and letting go. And people resist that. Because to let go of effort means to let go of the ego and the self. And when you first do that, sometimes it goes all wrong. You don't put any effort at all and nothing happens. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. Which is exactly the same as when I put my glass of water down. I'm holding it still. When I put it down, I'm moving it. It's actually moving more than it was a few seconds ago. But then it starts to slow down and stop. You see, the effort which people put in, the striving which is coming from the sense of self of trying to attain something, and it's abandoning the wrong thing. When we talk about grasping and attaching, that there's two ends to attaching. What you attach to, the objects of attachment, and the thing doing the attaching. And the problem with attachments is that too often all we see is the objects of attachment. We never go to the heart of the matter. What actually is doing the attaching? And so it's like two ends of an arm. You know, I've got my hand on one end of my arm, which does all the picking up. But I've got the other end of my arm. Where does all this intention to pick up come from? And I noticed as a young monk, I realized the one of the the aims of being a monk was to let go of all your attachments. So that's what I did when I became a monk. I let go of sex. And as soon as I let go of sex, I started getting attached to my food. That's what happens. And then you sort of, you know, let go of the attachments of food, and then you get attached to cups of tea. So you let go, give up your cups of tea, and then you get attached to something else. And every time I put something down, I'd always pick something up in the next few moments. And it just gets so hard to stop attaching to things. Until the insight came after many years. The reason why I pick up things is because I've got a hand, and that's what a hand does. The only way to stop picking up things is to cut off your hand. When you don't have anything to pick up things, then you won't pick them up. So it was like the thing doing the attaching inside. That's what I had to stop. And that is the controller, the doer, that where your effort comes from. That's the thing which is, causes all the problems. And it's a very deluding thing. Well, you know, you've got to do some effort, you've got to do these things, otherwise you'd never achieve anything. But here we have to go in the opposite direction to stop that effort. And then you find you naturally just go in and in and in. Effort is what moves the mind. When you don't move the mind, it gets more and more still. Zajan Chah said, like a leaf on a tree, it only moves because of the wind. If you take the wind away, the leaf moves less and less and less. Just be patient and it will stop completely in a short while. That effort is like the wind, always moving your body, your mind. After a while, you realize you get nowhere in meditation that way. You get a certain way, just like the symphony of the maze I said yesterday or this morning. You get so far and you get a block. You can't go any further with effort. But if you do let real letting go from the very beginning, you go all the way to the center of the goal. You just sit there and watch, and everything just unfolds by itself. Well, the Buddha's second teaching, one of his most powerful, which created the first enlightened beings. The first teaching created Stream Winner with Anya Kondanya. And he taught the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the teaching on non-self. He just looked upon this body and mind in terms of the five khandhas of this body, this vedana, the quality of pleasure and pain with every sensory experience, perception, mental formations and consciousness. And then he started sort of analyzing them, saying, if these things really belong to you, you'd be able to say, oh, may my vedana be like this, may my consciousness be like this, may my mental formations be like this. But, said the Buddha, you can't do that because these things don't belong to you. They're part of nature. They've got nothing to do with you. Therefore, you can just leave them alone. The Buddha was saying very clearly, You can't say, oh, may my mind be like this, may my mind be like that. All effort goes against the goal. It just moves the mind away from the Dhamma. So leave it alone. Sit there and stop. Stop all this effort and striving and trying to get somewhere. If you can really do that, you find the meditation works so wonderfully well. But for you to do that needs more than my advice. You've got to move against a whole lifetime, many lifetimes of conditioning, always for the self to do things. It's just what the nature of the self is. An ego is what puts forth effort. Big egos really can push hard. That's why you can see them on sports fields or on the Commonwealth Games or Olympics. They push themselves so hard, big egos, to get on the podium. But if you didn't have that ego, you just sit down there and be still. That makes sense? Give it a try, see what happens. Is there another question? Was that it? Okay, here we go. Next one. When the past and the future have been put down, there is still something left, like crumbs at the bottom of a cornflake packet. Someone is thinking of breakfast. A million fragments of debris clogging up consciousness and making one pointedness impossible. I don't know how to put them down. They don't seem to belong to me. I seem to belong to them. It's as if somebody outside has left a radio on, tuned between stations. Thank you, Ajahn. Okay, when the mind seems to be going crazy and you've got all these thoughts, the crumbs at the end of the bottom of the cornflake box, as you say, just the one thing you can always do in every state of meditation is just to make peace with whatever you're experiencing. Stop fighting, leave it alone. One of the key experiences of my life as a meditator, the 6 years as a monk in this monastery in the north of Thailand, a perfect monastery. You know, I was an English monk. I found this wonderful monastery in the middle of a tea plantation. I had all the tea I could ever drink. And it was abandoned. There's no one staying there. And it was high up in the mountains. There was no traffic. And the food was really good. It was perfect paradise for meditators. And I had the 3 months of the retreat all to myself in this monastery. And the villagers there, they weren't interested in listening to Buddhism. I thought that was wonderful, because I just want to be left alone to meditate. And that's what I did for 3 months. But after 1 or 2 weeks of meditating there, my mind started to get a bit out of control. You try to sort of make the mind still and peaceful, but then all these thoughts started coming up into my mind. And the usual way I describe them is unmonkish thoughts. Even though I was a very diligent monk, and I was trying to do the best, I just could not get these thoughts out of my mind. And thoughts about old girlfriends, thoughts about all sorts of stuff. And the harder I tried, the worse it got. My big problem was I was alone in this monastery. I had no one to ask any advice from. And so it got worse and worse, until one day it got so bad I couldn't stand it any longer. I thought I was going crazy. So I went to the main hall. It had a Buddha statue there. I bowed and asked for some sort of help, some inspiration. I was desperate. And the insight which came up, the idea which I had, because I was a Westerner, was to do a deal, to make a bargain with my mind. And the bargain was this: for most of the day I would watch my breath. That was my meditation object. But from 3 to 4 p.m. every day, I would allow my mind to think whatever it wanted to think. Anything goes. Sex, romance, the most deviant fantasies, a sport, whatever you want to do. From 3 to 4, anything goes. But for the rest of the time, please watch the breath. that seemed to make sense at the time. If you give yourself like an hour of free time, you can mind, you can indulge whatever you want, anything goes. I thought you'd have, you know, your play time, now we can go back to work and watch The Breath. However, it never worked out the way I expected. When I was trying to watch The Breath, still these thoughts would come in. And I think many of you meditators know what it's like. Thoughts come in, you try and keep them out, and they come in even worse. And I was struggling all day trying to, you know, keep these thoughts out of my mind. I was a monk, for goodness sake. I was supposed to be a good monk. I didn't want these thoughts, but they came in anyway. And then we got to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the time when I could actually just let my mind do whatever it wanted to do. So I went up to my room and I leant against the wall. I put my feet up because you know what it's like when you've been meditating all day, your legs are sore, your back is sore. So I leant against the wall, put my feet out and say, okay mind, whatever you want to think now, sex, romance, anything goes. And then for the next hour my mind just watched every breath go in, every breath go out, and it was just so easy and so peaceful. And it really sort of shook me that why, when I just said, okay mind, do whatever you want to do, it just watched the breath. But when I was trying to keep the mind still, it was just going all over the place. And of course, it was the meaning with Ajahn Chah Simli. I was actually feeding sort of the wandering mind with all of my effort. I was adding fuel to the fire, like pouring petrol on a fire. It was just getting worse. The more I struggled, the more restless I became. But as soon as I let go, I said, okay mind, if you want to do that, whatever you want to do, or anything goes, I make peace with it, then everything slowed down and stopped. When you understand this, the physics, how the mind works, you understand where all restlessness comes from. You make the mind restless because you're trying to get involved with it, stopping it, controlling it. You're stirring it up. Whenever you hold something, it moves. Leave it alone, it's still. So you create the restlessness. You disturb the noise, as Ajahn Chah would say. When you understand that point, meditation is easy. Whatever thoughts come up, you just make peace with them, leave them alone. They go by themselves. They're nothing to do with you, not your business. Thoughts come in, they go. So those crumbs at the bottom of the cornflake box, they don't belong to you. They're not your business, so you should neither throw them away nor keep them. Just leave them alone, pay no attention to them, and then they just disappear. Yes. Go on. Yeah, you can give instructions to your mind, but sometimes people give so many instructions to your mind that sometimes that your mind just gets instructed out. And how many instructions do you need? Like, it's amazing, just on these retreats, give like 2 hour talks a day and interviews as well. And one of my heroes, one of the great monks, is this monk called Ajahn Gunha. And the only meditation instructions he ever gives is just breathe in Sabai, breathe out Sabai, and that's it. Doesn't teach anything more than that. Breathe in Sabai and out Sabai. Sabai means nice and easy. He keeps it simple. Sometimes that we make it complicated, and sometimes that I indulge complicated people with giving instructions too much. But sometimes you need to do that. But okay, you can give yourself little instructions to start off with, but not very many. It's just like pandering to the controller, to the doer, just for a little bit. Just the instructions, shh, or stop, or make peace, let go, just watch, doesn't belong to me. Door of my heart's open to this moment, whether it's the dregs of a cornflakes box or the dregs of the muesli jar, whatever it is, just I make peace with it. The door of my heart's open to it. If you open the door of your heart to every moment, which means not trying to get rid of it, not trying to keep it, Because we adore, it goes in, but it also goes out again as well. And that way, just whatever experience is happening in this moment, it all just disappears. So those are the only instructions. The instructions, stop doing things. Leave it alone. Shh. That's the best instruction. Does that make sense? Hope it does. So that's the cornflakes box one. So I seem to belong to them. If they don't go away, sometimes as the thoughts come in your mind and they keep on lingering, then it's a good thing to investigate why those thoughts are still coming on there. It's because, you know, you're getting involved in them somewhere. If I just came in here this evening, I just sat here and I never gave a talk, then most of you would actually, you know, walk out of here and go into your rooms and have a snooze. Go to bed. It's only when you engage with things that the things stay. If you didn't engage, the things would leave and go somewhere else. So if the thoughts or the problem lingers, you're engaging somewhere with that. You're feeding it. So that's why if any sort of thoughts or train of thoughts continues in my mind, I look and say, well, what am I doing here? I'm feeding that somewhere. I'm interested in it. And when you have that interest in there, you don't leave it alone, but you want to get rid of it, which is another form of interest. It stays. As soon as you leave it alone, you disengage. It always, every time, disappears. It only stays because of your interest. You're making it important, therefore it stays. So leave it alone, let it go. Thoughts come, feelings come, not my business, it's just part of nature, just a play of samsara. Leave it alone, disengage, and then it disappears. Okay, so it's not you belong to them, but you know, you're always doing the owning. Sounds are just sounds, part of nature. Try the next one. How do you differentiate between tiredness and sloth and torpor, i.e. plain old laziness of the mind? Usually the first couple of days of retreat put it down to tiredness, physical tiredness. However, by the end of this retreat, if you are still sort of going to sleep just after the talk in the evening and just managing to get up before breakfast at 7 o'clock, then you can take it for granted that sloth and torpor, plain laziness of the mind. There must be a sort of a reason for it. And the first part of the retreat, it usually is just real tiredness, because as I said yesterday, a lot of you live a very stressful lifestyle, even me, so I'm tired as well. But I always notice this even in my retreats. When I come over here first day or two, I just start just talk about anything, who cares. But when you get to 2 or 3 days, you start getting your energy coming up, and that's when it really gets fun. That's why I love these retreats. I know what's going to happen the first couple of days, you know, a bit sort of dull. But when you really get into it, the sloth and bodily tiredness goes, and then you really get strong. Really, when you get sloth and torpor, it's more like boredom. That's when you're not getting enough joy from the meditation. And you don't get joy from the meditation when you put too much effort in. Because this is a basic rule of the mind of meditation. Many of you have heard this before, but it's fundamental to meditation. You've got two parts to the mind, the doer, the controller, which is thinking, willing, planning, all that sort of stuff belongs to the doer, the controller. The other half of the mind is the passive mind. It just knows, it can hear, it can listen, it can feel, but it doesn't react, it just knows. But those two parts of the mind, we give 99% of the energy to the controller. We're always doing things, managing things, thinking, going somewhere, making something happen. We're always controllers and doers. So much so that the energy just goes into that one place. Sloth and torpor is the lack of energy in the knower, in the passive part of the mind. And that's why there is a general dullness for the beginning of a retreat. If you follow the instructions, if you relax, you don't do very much, you just put your bottom on the seat and just let go, you will find, because you're not controlling, doing, making something happen, the energy which you have, you aren't wasting it in doing. It starts to be conserved, and it builds up in the only place it can go, in mindfulness, awareness, bare knowing, the passive conscious awareness of phenomena. And after a while that builds up and builds up, and you tend to feel like you're waking up. You're coming out of a dullness, of a sloth, when you go into this meditation retreat more and more. The mindfulness increases. The more you do, the more active you are, the more effort you put in, the weaker mindfulness becomes. See, effort causes the tiredness, as you should know. But if you let go, leave things alone, the mind starts to wake up. Energy starts to come. And you know this when you get all these wonderful experiences. The food tastes more delicious. The carpet looks brilliant, as if it's just been cleaned. The bricks have just got so much detail in them, and the flowers outside, wow, they just blow you away. They're incredibly beautiful. What's happening is the mindfulness is increasing. The energy is going into mindfulness, and whatever you see is beautiful. And that's an important part of the meditation. When the mindfulness is that strong, you look at the present moment, it's not boring at all. It's incredible just what's happening in this moment. It just grabs your attention. Silence. Wow, it's so delicious. And the breath. Wow, that's amazing. The breath is always like that, but we're so dull because we're so tired because we've done so much. That's why it's difficult to watch the breath. And that is also one of the reasons why, after all these years of teaching meditation, I don't tell people to watch the breath straight away. I try to entertain you, or just keep you somehow or other from doing things for the first couple of days, just to try and get the energies of the mind up. When the mindfulness starts to really get buzzing along, because you haven't wasted your energy doing things, then you can watch the breath, and it's so easy. The meditation becomes fun. You can meditate for long periods of time. You have fun, you enjoy doing it. It's not a struggle anymore. Stop and talk has disappeared, because the mind is energized. So that's the difference between sloth and torpor and the and the tiredness. Sloth and torpor, its cause is you've been struggling too much in your mind. Tiredness is because physically you've been running around. So please know the difference between the two of them. And after a while, the way to get rid of the sloth and torpor is by doing a lot of peaceful contentment, leaving things alone, and allowing the energy to come up. There was also my problem when I was a young monk, because I was heavily, highly motivated. Whatever I did, I used to put huge amounts of effort into it. And when we used to meditate in Thailand as a young monk, over 32 years ago, we used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you have to sit from 3:15, and you'd always be nodding. And there's one of the monks would actually keep his eyes open, and he'd just watch. And I was always a number two. I took about 3 minutes, and then I was nodding. And there's this other guy, Gary, you're nodding. And then Brahma Wangso, you're nodding as well. Every morning this would happen mostly. And I really tried hard to stop the sloth and torpor. I really struggled, but nothing worked. You know, one of those things which I did, the old story, I just put a matchbox on top of my head with the cover off, so that when you started nodding, the matchbox would fall off and you'd hear it and it'd go all over the floor. Because that's the way you could actually know that you were nodding. And after about 6 or 7 days of working with the matchbox, I solved the problem, so I thought. The matchbox never fell off in the morning when I was sitting meditation. And I thought, at last, I stopped my nodding problem. And then the senior monk came up and said, Ajahn Brahm, come over here. I'll show you what you're doing. You're still nodding, but now you're nodding like this. You are compensating subconsciously so the matchbox never fell off. You're still nodding. And it's just so frustrating when you hear things like that, because you really struggled hard. And so what I did, like many people do, you put even more effort in. You really go for it. And you say, right, I'm going to watch the breath no matter what. And you force yourself when you push through the sloth and torpor. The sloth and torpor would disappear. And what would be left with? Restlessness. The thinking all over the place. I couldn't get my mind still at all. And so you calm the mind down. And as soon as the restlessness disappeared, you're back to sleep again. Now, is that your problem? You're either restless or you're slothful. That was my problem for such a long time. And I'd never got any decent advice. If I'd have only listened to Ajahn Chah instead of the other Western monks, I'd have actually probably done much better. It was like a pendulum. You were at either extreme, either dull or just thinking too much. And it's only years afterwards, when you had the guts to let go, the courage to just, okay, if I'm asleep, I'm asleep. Leave it alone, who cares? It's just cause and effect. And I said, this is one of the things, I realised it was cause and effect. What would you expect? There I was, number one, 3 o'clock in the morning, getting up to meditate. And you know, we don't need to try and do 4 hours a night. There wasn't enough sleep. I was terribly sleep deprived. The food in that monastery was disgusting. So, you know, I was probably drained of all vitamins and everything else. I was malnourished. It was in a tropical climate. And there I was, you know, an Englishman, you know, from sort of a cold country. And there was in the tropics. And just the whole thing was just obvious. You know, that you're going to get slothful and torpor at that time in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, in a hot country, sort of malnourished, sleep deprived. It's obvious you're going to get tired. It's just laws of cause and effect, that's all. So I was actually trying to fight nature. It's a stupid thing to do. It's just ego again. I can control it. And so when you learn how to let go, no, it's just nature, leave it alone, who cares? Then, because you let go, whatever energy you had left, you didn't waste it trying to struggle, just sat there, made peace with your sloth and torpor. You didn't fight it, you had kindness, metta towards it. Sloth and torpor, the door of my heart's open to you. Then, because you never fought it, actually quite quickly, only a few minutes, it just faded away, and my energy sort of came up again. And when the sloth and torpor vaporized, what was left was not restlessness, but this very deep peace. I realized just what was going on there. By not struggling, by not wasting my mental energy, all the mental energy was just going into mindfulness. My mind was slowly waking up. And when the energy kept going into the mindfulness, because I wasn't doing anything, when my mind did wake up, it was still, and the restlessness had been abandoned. That's how I meditate. Leave it alone. If you're tired, just allow the body to droop. It will just straighten up by itself, and it's a wonderful experience just to watch. It's just thing, this whole mind and body does it by itself. You just don't do anything. You just watch it. And the energy comes back that way. As a monk, I do many, many things. I have many demands on my time. Whenever I get tired, that's what I just do. I don't struggle with the tiredness. I don't fight it. I just make peace. Make it very, very still. And the energies come back so quickly. I'm very good at doing that now. That's why I can do so much and have lots of energy. Because the mental energy comes from stillness. Ajahn Chah said that. That's why I said, if I'd have listened to my teacher and understood what he was saying, I'd have done much better, much quicker. The energy of the body comes from exercise, from doing things. The energy of the mind comes from being still. It's one of his great sayings. The more still you are, the more energy comes into your mind. So if you've got sloth and torpor, don't fight it, be still. You haven't got any energy, you've got little energy, so don't waste what little you have. Be still. Wait. The energy just comes back into the mind and it just starts to dispel the mists of sloth and torpor. That's actually how we do it. So it's a great way of doing it, and it works just so wonderfully well. To Ajahn Brahm, it is only one day into the retreat and my nose is beginning to run. My feet are beginning to smell. Okay, your nose runs, your feet are supposed to run, your nose is beginning to smell. Have I been turned upside down already? It's a joke. So thank you for that joke. Because noses are supposed to do the smelling and the feet are supposed to do the running. But he says, your nose is beginning to run, my feet are beginning to smell. Have I been turned upside down already? No, not at all, just carry on. Next question. Ajahn, can you explain devotion? My goodness. Where devotion comes actually from? I wonder if it has any meat coming from devas, from devotion. Because devas are like the word for gods. But like really devotion is sometimes is when we... It's like a form of attachment, really, isn't it, devotion? Where you're attached to some person or something. And it's probably not a very good thing to do, to be devoted to something. That's why for my monks in my monastery, I know that I'm really asking for a lot of problems when I say this, but I ask my monks to be rebellious. And the monks here know that I say this. Be rebellious, monks. Because if they're not rebellious, they're not really challenging, they're not going to get anywhere in their practice of meditation or in their practice of Dharma. So, to be rebellious, they've got to challenge. They've got to challenge themselves. They've got to challenge me. They've got to challenge the Buddha. Everything. Because sometimes too much devotion, if they're just following like blind sheep. This actually happened. One of the monks was actually brought up in a sheep farm. But he wasn't a sheep. But he remembered telling me once, he went out to sort of look for the sheep. And he found that these sheep had actually, didn't know how they'd started, how they got into this fix, but there was like a thicket of bushes, and the sheep had formed a circle around the big thicket of bushes, and they were going round and round and round and round in a complete circle. And he said if he hadn't sort of pulled one of them out, they'd be still going around in that circle to this day, all following each other. And that's called samsara. The cycle, the round of rebirth, you're going round and round like sheep. Now, because the thicket obscures the other side, you can't really see where you're going. But the one in front's going there, so they think it must be all right. So that's why if you're always like a creature of habit, like that sheep, you're missing the whole thing, the whole point. So even like as a monk, don't be a sheep monk. You're supposed to be sort of an individual. Be rebellious. Do it your way. And okay, it's tough being a teacher. It's wonderful if everybody was a clone and did the right thing, but it's the same as this retreat over here. It would be much easier for me if I said, right, 4 o'clock, everybody out of the bed, 4:15, in here meditating, 5 o'clock, everybody stop meditating, 5 minute toilet break, 5:05, we do the chanting, sort of 4:15, everybody walking meditation, 6 o'clock, everybody doing this. It'd be to regiment like that, and some retreats do that. It'd make my life easy, but it'd be just missing the whole point. It'd be like controlling. I'll be teaching you to control, and I don't want to teach my monks I'm going to control you, monks. I want you to be rebellious, but I want you to take that rebellion right deep inside, rebel against everything you've known. Rebel against all of your ideas. Rebel against your attachments. Question to the very limit. And if you can do that,
you go against the stream. It's a hard thing to go against the stream, but those people who are rebellious do so. And too many devoted people, sometimes they miss the whole point of practice. You get devoted, you go and put the incense into the shrine and you sort of bow and you do all these ceremonies. You're a very devoted Buddhist, but you're a stupid Buddhist. You know, you're just a devotee. No matter what you're doing it for. So it's great to actually know, what did you come on this retreat for anyway? What do you do this for? Is this another act of devotion? You think you can get something out of this? So we actually look, what do you come here for? And you come actually to find a deeper truth, to find some real peace. And to do that, you know, you can't go on the same way you've been going all your life. You've got to go in a different direction. Because, you know, you've gone to other retreats, you know, you've gone to other places, you've done this, you've done that. But how about doing it in a completely different way, a rebellious way? No control, no doing. Completely letting go. You can't rebel more than that. If you're rebelling against your ego and your pride, you're doing. That's the biggest thing to rebel against. You're going against the stream of craving, of wanting. That's what we rebel against. Yes. Yeah. I don't know if that really works, because those people, they actually go along and say how many retreats, those retreats they've done. They wear the retreats like a badge of ego. I think actually you get to sit in the front. The ones who've done the most retreats sit in the front, and if you're just a beginner, you sit in the back. Yeah, it sounds a bit like a sort of pride trip to me. But it's also, it's missing the point, because when the teacher controls you, he's telling you that control is a good thing. That's a way to overcome the ego. And that you tend to try and control yourself. You control your body, you try and control your meditation, control your breath, control your thoughts. People get so tense. Now, you know all those stories. When I first went to, I think, Malaysia, before I went to Singapore, people started calling it samadhi headache, meditation headache, which was amazing that I could hear such a word. Because for all the years I'd been in Thailand, I'd never heard meditation headache before, because we never did that regimented forceful technique. It was just not meditation headache, meditation freedom and bliss and happiness and joy. That's what my meditation was all about, not this regimented. And it never made any sense to me either, because you're not, it's not the teacher, it's not the routine you submit to. You submit to nature. You let go to nature, not to sort of some artificial routine. That's why when you feel tired, you go to bed. When you wake up in the morning, doesn't matter what time it is, you just get up and meditate. It's much better. That way you tend to meditate much longer. No, I just rebel against it. In other words, rebelling is you're not being a devotee. You're thinking for yourself. If you're not even thinking, you're just rebelling against even the thoughts. You're just shouting up. That's important to be able to do that, because if you become creatures of habit, then your mindfulness becomes so weak. Mindfulness, one of its qualities is never doing the same thing twice. So one of the exercises in mindfulness which I teach is tomorrow morning. When you get up and you brush your teeth, which I hope you do, you've got these basins right in your room to brush your teeth with. You don't need to go anywhere, it's right there. But when you brush your teeth tomorrow morning, before you put that toothbrush in your mouth, ask yourself, what
side of the mouth do you usually start? We have creatures of habit. Most of you always start in the same place, and you've been doing it for years. Tomorrow morning, start in a different place. Every morning of this retreat, start brushing your teeth in a different position of your mouth. A different even tooth. Start a different place. And you'll find, because you're rebelling against your devotion to habit, that you will become more alert and more awake. Even those of you who settled your nice place in this room, you've got your little corner there, tomorrow morning move somewhere else. No, I know that some people have already got the corners, which is very, very expensive property in this retreat centre. Anyone who's got a wall or a corner, you should be able to sort of sell that to the person sitting next to you for a lot of money, especially when there's 8 days to go. But it's nice to do things a bit differently. Even when you're meditating, turn around the other direction. Do it different. Turn around this way, that way. Anything to do it different. Please do not be a creature of habit. Because if you're a creature of habit, you lose your mindfulness. That's why that some people don't even know what side of the mouth they start brushing their teeth on. Because they just don't pay any attention. It's just a habit. So when we become rebellious, it's like we wake up, we do things in a different way. And I have a lot of fun being rebellious. You know that my backwards meditation technique, which I developed a few years ago. Because meditating on the breath, it can get very boring, breathing in and breathing out. So I developed the backwards meditation technique. This is completely unique to Ajahn Brahm's teaching. No other teacher has ever, not even the Buddha, not Ajahn Chah. This was an original invention of me. The backwards breathing technique is you breathe out first and then you breathe in. Now, you may think that that is not different at all, but you try it. Breathe three times, three cycles, and now breathe out first and then in. See, it is much different. That's what I mean about about being rebellious, doing things in a different way. You make interesting discoveries, you make more fun for your meditation. What it is actually when you become a creature of habit, your mindfulness disappears, you become dull. You just become like, you know, a meditation clone. You never get anywhere in life, especially in meditation. So do things differently. Sit in a different place, sit under a tree, whatever. And that way you become more alive. And when you're mindful, you're awake, meditation goes more deep. You get more joy, more fun. Too much devotion and you become dead. That makes sense? Okay, what's nice? Oh, that's actually, it's amazing. I managed to stretch these questions out to the full hour. So thank you very much for asking those questions. That's something else. Is that all the questions or was there another one? No, that's a short one. Okay, very good. So, don't expect too much this evening. Who knows, though, what might happen? When you least expect it, that's when enlightenment happens. So just enjoy the evening and give yourself a bit of a break. Don't stay up too late. Have a nice rest. Because the first day or two, we just, you know, leave it alone. It's just settling in time. Don't expect anything at all. You're not going to get anything the first night. That's maybe then you might get something. So be completely rebellious. If you feel really awake, just stay up. Don't just go to bed because I say to go to bed. Rebel against me. I don't know if you're going to rebel against that one, though. I'll just enjoy the evening and see you in the morning. So good night.